SiriusXM presents Stanford Pathfinders.
Stanford has 225,000 alumni living all over the globe in 151 countries, and they're some of the most amazing people you would ever want to meet.
A show about how the graduates of Stanford University are changing our lives and the world.
We'll hear very interesting things from business leaders in the technology sector, but well beyond that, the worlds of politics, entertainment, business, and beyond.
Inspiring stories from America's innovation heartland.
It's a place where people look to the future, not to the past, where they don't rest on their laurels. Think about the gold rush. Think about Stanford being formed in the late 1800s. And then Stanford was the beginning of Silicon Valley. And the ethos of Silicon Valley is deeply embedded in the Stanford spirit. It's a spirit of innovation, experimentation. It's a spirit of being willing to try new things and risk failure as long as you fail forward.
Welcome to Stanford Pathfinders.
A lawyer and cultural anthropologist.
This generation has been called as pragmatic as the World War II generation.
Co-author of Gen Z Explained, The Art of Living in a Digital Age.
They were different. Their values seemed different. Their behaviors seemed different. And we all felt that.
This week on Stanford Pathfinders, Roberta Katz. Now here's your host, Howard Wolf.
Everywhere I look these days, I see articles about Gen Z, and most articles appear highly judgmental. A recent article, for instance, was entitled, "Gen Z has arrived at the office and it's freaking everyone out." That title might be more than a bit hyperbolic, but it points to a general sense that the members of Gen Z are different from their predecessor generations and that we better watch out. For those of us who have been on the planet for a while, we recognize that every generation seems to have things to say about those who follow. The talk about Gen Z, however, seems more abundant and robust than past such judgments, and it's got people talking. Today's guest on Stanford Pathfinders, Roberta Katz, recognized this buzz and set out several years ago to figure out what makes Gen Z different than prior generations. What does it mean to be a cohort that lives deeply in the digital age? The first generation never to know the world before the internet. What can we of more mature years learn from them? What do they have to offer to the world? A Stanford undergraduate alumna, Roberta also attended Columbia University, where she earned a PhD in anthropology, as well as the University of Washington, where she earned a law degree. After working for decades in the technology industry, including a stint as general counsel at Netscape, when it introduced the internet browser to the world, Roberta returned to the academy to work at Stanford, where she is now a senior research scholar, and she has much to share with us about Gen Z. Roberta, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Howard. Lovely to be here.
So you've written this book, Generation Z, Explained, The Art of Living in a Digital Age. So let's start at the very beginning. What is Generation Z? What's Gen Z? Who are they?
Right, Gen Z, you know, first of all, let me just say generational research is always going to be a little bit looking at normative stuff. It's not going to describe every single person who is in a generation, but it reflects the fact that people of a certain age tend to go through some similar, very important experiences in their lives. So Generation Z tends to be people born, it's kind of defined that the beginning and ending are not always agreed, but more or less around the mid-1990s as the beginning, up to more or less 2010 as the end. And then that, when that ends, we begin something called Generation Alpha.
So
today these kids are, they're in their 20s down to their teens.
So like, working at Stanford University, both of us, the students who are there today are fundamentally Gen Z students.
They are indeed.
All right, so help us understand why you and your three co-authors decided to write this book. Was there a specific catalyst? Was this something that was just on your mind? How did this come into being?
So it came into being, let me just mention that the co-authors were all at Stanford at the time that we got the idea to do this. Jane Shaw was the Dean of Religion, Dean for Religious Life, and Sarah Ogilvie was in the Linguistics Department. By the way, Jane is also a historian. And then we had a visitor, Linda Woodhead, who was coming to us from a university in England, was visiting Stanford. We got together for dinner and we started sharing stories, anecdotes about the students that we were teaching or advising. And we all said, these kids are different. It's not just that they're young, because they're the same age as students from prior years coming through, but they were different. Their values seemed different. Their behaviors seemed different. And we all felt that. And we said, you know, we need to understand this better. And since we came from four different disciplines, we said, wouldn't it be fun to kind of combine our disciplinary knowledge and see what we learn? And so before we started the study, we went up to the Center for Advanced Study of Behavioral Sciences to ask Margaret Levy, the head of CASBIS, it's called. We said, Margaret, are we nuts? Is this a good idea for a study? It would be very multidisciplinary, but we're all interested in this topic. And Margaret said, I think it's a great topic. It's a needed topic. And the next thing I knew, two weeks later, she called and she said, I've found your funding. So we were off and running.
Kismet.
It was kismet.
All right. So most pundits who I read are highly critical of this generation. I mean, they throw out all kinds of monikers for students and young people that are Gen Z. But as I read your book, I kept on looking for that. But instead, you were decidedly not critical of this generation.
Right.
Why is that? You're different. This book is a different sort of focus, a different summary and conclusion than other articles and books that I've read on this topic.
Yeah. And I have to say, we started off feeling more critical than we ended up. But the more we interacted with these young people, the more we talked with them, the more we heard from them about what they cared about. We did over 100 interviews with students at Stanford, students at Foothill College, students at a university in England called Lancaster, which is in the north of England. And we heard their voices. And the more we came to understand how they were seeing the world and what they were contending with, the more respect we developed for them. And we tried in the book to represent them, not because we were trying to advocate for them, but because we feel like there's been poor understanding of where they're coming from by people in older generations. And we wanted to build some bridges.
Well, I think you did exactly that. So there are many things that sort of set Gen Z aside. And one of those things is that this is the first generation to truly be digital natives. How important is that in defining this generation?
So we actually I don't think of them as digital natives. What I do think of them as is internet natives. So digital technology, the computer, so on and so forth, predated them. But what happened in 1995 that was absolutely seminal, and I knew this well because I was the general counsel of Netscape, is that the world got access to this extremely powerful communications network called the internet. The browser, which was kind of introduced more or less publicly in 1995, gave us access. And that was the beginning of this flowering of websites and all kinds of things that could be done online. All the online stuff that we do is relatively recent. The first Amazon sold its first book in 1995 online. I mean, everything that we do online now didn't happen until 1995.
So one of the ways that a friend of mine put this is that as more mature people, you and I, we use the internet as a tool, and young people of Gen Z, it's the oxygen they breathe.
Well, I'd just say they're more adept users of the tool. One of the things that we found about these young people is that they're not wanting to give up their quintessentially human behavior and characteristics. They're not giving themselves over totally to the technology. In fact, it's just the opposite. They're really trying to preserve a lot of what we would call very human, but they're really good at using the tools to live differently. And they have to live differently because what they're exposed to is so much greater in and I'm going to use this word a lot, these words a lot, scope, scale, speed. Life today happens at a much faster speed. The scope and the scale of what we get access to in terms of information in the information age is so much greater. So they have a huge amount to process.
And you make a point in the book that was fascinating to me, because one of the things that you hear bandied about Gen Z is that they're snowflakes. They're precious little things. They're so unbelievably hypersensitive. And the point you make in the book is that that's not really true. They're protecting themselves because of the scale, the scope, and the speed with which they encounter the world. Talk to us a little bit about that.
So some of the reason they're called snowflakes is that it appears to those of us who are older that they're doing things that look way too protective of themselves. And when you talk to them, they say, look, we're just doing things differently.
And at the same time, you raise some fascinating points in the book about their views of different things that you and I might take for granted. So let's talk about one of those. Institutions. How does Gen Z view institutions? And why is there such seeming distrust of institutions?
So I want you to put yourself in the shoes of someone who is, say, 10 years old and has access to an online world and reads about scandals, first of all, may have experienced the 2008 recession and parents losing jobs, certainly learns more about the gig economy, learns about, we had all sorts of scandals in religious organizations, we had scandals in political organizations. And so we might have grown up thinking these institutions were quite stable, solid, trustworthy. What they've experienced in the last 20 years is not that. They've seen, those of us who are older have seen the same stuff, but we have a different foundation. Our foundation comes from when those institutions seemed quite stable. They may or may not have been. But if you think about the decline of trust in general, it's not just a decline of trust by young people. In our society, there are all these studies about the decline of trust in all kinds of institutions. That's the climate in which these young people grew up.
We've lived a time where we actually had faith in institutions that they delivered. These young people have lived in an era where the institutions really haven't.
Exactly. Maybe they have in some cases, but the prevailing sort of notion out in the world is that they are not trustworthy.
So related to this is also a different view of leadership. I found this a fascinating discussion in your book, that they view leadership differently than prior generations, what a leader is and how leaders should step up, and the disdain for hierarchical organizations. Give us a sense for how you understand Gen Z's view of leadership.
Yeah. This is such an interesting part of what we learned, and it made total sense the more we thought about it. So these are the young people who, from the time they were in elementary school, were being were given group assignments. I remember when I was growing up, the notion of a group assignments would have made no sense at all. But I remember even when my children came home and said, "Yeah, we've been assigned this as a group. It'll be a group grade." And I said, "But what if somebody in the group doesn't do their part?" They said, "Well, I'll have to deal with that." So they've dealt with groups in their educational experiences, and then if you think about what they've experienced online, it's been very much about groups. I mean, think about Wikipedia, think about GoFundMe, think about fan fiction, think about all these social media sites where people can contribute and kind of help create with games. They can help create games together. And that is often done without a leader. And so when we asked, one of the things we asked our interviewees, we said, what kind of leadership do you prefer? And we thought we would hear, we prefer something like servant leadership or whatever. A surprising number of students said, we don't think you actually need a leader, or you can have a rotating leader. You use a leader for one task because that leader is really good at it. But when you have another task, somebody else from the group becomes the leader because they're really good at it. So in their experience, work has gotten done without a formal roster of leaders. So, you know, if you take someone our age and you say, okay, we're going to have this group without a leader, we're kind of like, what? You don't have a president, a vice president, a secretary, and a treasurer? How can you possibly know who's in charge?
Well, it also informs how they look at institutions, because institutions very much are about hierarchical leadership, right? So if you don't believe in leadership of that format, you probably don't have much faith in institutions as well. So there's another part of this book that fascinated me. I mean, I got to tell you, I highly recommend this book to everyone who cares about understanding Gen Z, because it opened my eyes and gave me a framework to think about these things. Identity.
Yes.
Wow. This appears to mean something totally different to Gen Z than prior generations.
Yes.
How, why? Give us a sense for how they view identity.
So identity is the thing that a lot of parents and just older people in general really cannot understand about this generation. And the young people know this is something that is kind of a wedge between them and some of their elders. The best way to explain their approach to identity is to go back to what I said about scope, scale, and speed of the internet. In the old days, when we were trying to figure out who we are during our young teen and teenage years, we had relatively few models to look at. We didn't have access to a large number of models. These young people today have a world of between 7 and 8 billion people who can serve as models. They have access to all kinds of other ways of living beyond those which they experience in their own home and in their own hometown. And so they recognize that there are a number of ways to be. And so when they're online, when they're exploring different websites, they're trying things on. Does this feel like me? Does this feel like the real me? And they build an identity piece by piece. We all have many pieces to our identities. You're the head of the Alumni Association at Stanford. You are a father, you are a husband, you are a son. Those are all pieces of your identity. When you're online and when you're looking at the variety of ways of living online, you can actually find a lot more pieces, and you're kind of putting together the jigsaw puzzle of who you are. You are also free to change that as you keep exploring. So gender has been one of those places where young people have seen that there are many, many, many ways of approaching gender and sexuality. And that's the one that we're most aware of as older people. We're kind of sometimes going like, what do you mean? There are like, you know, 20 different ways of defining one's gender or one's sexuality. It has to do with all this pronoun usage and so on. So, but the important thing for us to think about is that today, because of the internet and because of the scope, scale, and speed, these young individuals have more agency to choose for themselves as opposed to being assigned an identity.
This is Stanford Pathfinders. I'm Howard Wolf. More with Roberta Katz, co-author of the new book, Gen Z Explained, The Art of Living in a Digital Age. This is Stanford Pathfinders. I'm Howard Wolf, and I'm speaking with cultural anthropologist and co-author Roberta Katz about her new book, Gen Z Explained, The Art of Living in a Digital Age. I am a boomer. I think you are as well.
I am.
And I have been the victim of okay, boomer sort of comments in the past. So give us a sense for how Gen Z views boomers like me or like you.
Yeah. I think okay, boomer is a bit of a public act more than how they really feel about older people. I think at least the people we interviewed have affection for us boomers. In many cases, we're their grandparents. So there's that natural affinity between grandparents and grandchildren. But they are disappointed in all the older generations for not doing more to deal with the kinds of big problems that their generation is facing. Whether it's income inequality or climate change or violence, gun violence, they look at all this and say, you had a chance to work on this before, why didn't you? So there is a sense of disappointment that goes along with this sense they have that it's all on their shoulders and they're gonna have to figure it out together.
Is it disappointment or is it blame?
I think for some it's blame, but I think for many it's just, it's resignation. It's kind of, you guys didn't handle this, now we have to. There's a lot of resignation. This generation has been called as pragmatic as the World War II generation. They're very pragmatic. They're kind of like, okay, we're facing this. We're gonna have to deal with it. You all didn't do it, but we have to.
Okay, so let's talk about belonging.
Sure.
This is a term I'd never heard before, modular belonging.
Right.
What is it and why does it matter?
So again, it's related to what I said before about all the different parts of your identity. When you are online and you are participating in various groups online, mm-hmm. each one of those groups has its own set of norms and rules for how to behave. Sometimes there even are moderators who enforce those rules, as it were. Again, with the internet, you have the opportunity to belong to lots more groups, each of which is going to impose on you in some form some identifiers if you're part of that group. You can switch those around. You can be in a group online for a while and then decide it's not meeting your needs, you're not getting out of it what you need, and you go to a different one. But the composite of all those different places that you belong is modular belonging. And with that goes the notion that each of these little places has their own set of rules. It's not that different in quality from what we've always experienced. When you go visit a grandparent, you have one set of behaviors. When you go visit your workplace, you have another set of behaviors. When you go to your place of religion, you have a third set of behaviors. It's just that with the internet and with social media, we have so many more places that we can belong and where we have to kind of follow the social code that goes with each one of those.
So we've established that the Gen Zers are disappointed, was the language that you use. That's the word you use, with the mess we've made of the world. And they'd like to change that. They want to fix the world. And how do they see themselves making change happen? And how does this relate to activism? Because many people have described Gen Z as the most activist generation since the generation that came of age in the 60s.
Right. Interestingly enough, and we talked about this in the book, they venerate activists, many of them do, and they don't deem themselves worthy of being called activists unless they are utterly devoted to a cause. It's interesting. We would ask them, do you consider yourself an activist? And they would say, oh, no, I don't do enough. I think one of the reasons people see them as activists is, again, because they are adept at using the tools, this massive communications network that is the internet, to organize themselves. And so you see the Greta Thunbergs of the world who have been very successful at engaging people. So they can act en masse a lot more. Whether or not that makes a difference is gonna depend on what happens after people come together. And that varies across communities and across causes. So there are people studying the political behavior of these young people. I think it's going to be very telling to see how they engage with the political system or whether they feel they have to go outside the political system to make some changes.
So final question. I suspect we have many, many listeners who have either as a stakeholder group, as a customer group, as a client group, you name it, people in this generation, Gen Z people, Gen Zers. And in our last couple of minutes, what advice would you give to people in the nonprofit world, people in the business world, it doesn't matter, anyone who has to work with and serve Gen Zers?
This is a great question, because Gen Zers come into the workplace with an attitude of, I can, you don't need to tell me, I can do it. And that attitude sometimes is helpful and sometimes it is not at all helpful. If you think about how Gen Zers get their information and have long gotten their information, they use a lot of self-help. If they need to know something, they go to the internet. So they are somewhat dismissive of expertise that is given kind of without them seeking it. It's not that they don't like expertise. They'll go and find an expert when they feel they need the information. So they come into the workplace, they have a lot of self-agency, and suddenly someone slots them in and expects them to, as we all did, kind of, you know their place. And they're not used to operating that way. So they can seem very in your face and disrespectful, and they don't understand why people are not appreciating what they bring. So the advice I give, and I'm sure some people will chafe against it, is as an older person to actually listen to them, not because you're going to necessarily take at wholesale value what they're saying, but they do deserve a hearing. And then mutually so, they need to learn to listen. So some of the traditional ways that we've done things are right and will stay right going into the future, but some of them are not. And these young people can help us see what is not right and that there are better ways as we look to the future.
What great counsel and advice. Roberta, thank you so very much for being on the show. I thoroughly enjoyed this, and I recommend this book to everyone or anyone who wants to understand Generation Z.
Thank you so much, Howard. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Stanford Pathfinders on SiriusXM. Listen to this and other episodes anytime on demand with the SiriusXM app or wherever you like to find your podcasts.